Riding in the back of the armored luxury sedan, Habib ibn Thabit gazed out over the white buildings clustered along the seacoast of Algiers and ignored the noise in the trunk. Evidently, his guest's sedative had worn off early. It was no matter, though. Bab el-Wed, what was once the fishing district, teemed with noise. These days, the fishing boats in the harbor shared anchorage with tourist boats and private yachts. Much of the world recognized Algiers as a dangerous place to be, though, so there were very few upstanding citizens on the water, and that made it an even better place to do illegal business. Habib's own yacht, Shabana, lay out there waiting for him. So did two cargo ships he was currently doing business with. If he hadn't had a mole in his organization, he would have only needed one vessel, but that was working out to his advantage. Habib had learned to be a man who took what God provided and made a feast of it. In fact, he was making a feast today. In his late 30s, he was a powerful man and handsome, which was confirmed regularly by the many women who told him so. He'd hired a personal trainer and a groomer who traveled with him. The Americans, the Central Intelligence Agency, had tried to cultivate those people over the years, but Habib made it a point to never discuss business. He kept an inner circle, and no one ever got into it. The man in the trunk was scared, as he should be. He knew the end that he was about to meet. Habib had known exactly when the CIA had turned the man, and he used that knowledge against the Americans. They wanted him badly, but he always stayed one step ahead of them. No matter how hard they pursued him, and no matter the traps they set, he could not be enticed. His father had lived the same way, and in the end he had died of old age, not from an assassin's bullet. That was how Habib would die, too. The driver controlled the sedan easily, moving swiftly through the traffic. He was older than Habib, going gray at his temples, but he drove flawlessly. Habib looked at the two other men in the car, also in suits. They were older, marked by war and danger. Both sat with German machine pistols in their laps, attentive but relaxed. Habib pressed the intercom button that linked him to the driver's compartment.
Sanjay, are we still followed?
Yes, I have identified 5 cars. The other men have confirmed this. They are using a rolling tail, swapping out cars every few blocks. They are very good.
Do not lose them.
I won't.
How far are we from the meeting point?
1 mile, perhaps 3 minutes.
Habib took his thin sat phone from his jacket. He pressed speed dial and waited. The call was answered on the other end by Abdul Saidi.
Hello?
My friend, I look forward to meeting with you in a few minutes. I trust everything is in order.
Yes? You have my product?
I do.
I was told there were people, possibly Americans or Britons, watching your vessel.
Do not worry.
I will worry. I will not have you bring trouble to my doorstep.
There is no trouble I cannot handle. Everything will be well.
If it is not, you are to blame.
I will see you in a few minutes. If everything is not as I say, I will give you your product free of cost.
Habib closed his phone and put it away. He watched through the windshield as Sanjay drove the car through the next intersection and turned left. The sedan glided down a couple of alleys. The flotsam that lived in the alley shuffled away from the car out of self-preservation. A moment later, Sanjay pulled the sedan to a stop in front of a 3-story warehouse. The place was decrepit, the stone stained by countless years of hard use and bad weather. Most observers would think it was simply out of business. They wouldn't notice the windows covered in black paint or the closed-circuit cameras hugging the roofline above. The warehouse doors parted down the middle and slid sideways on well-oiled rollers. A row of lights shone down the center of the building, displaying the emptiness of the warehouse. The place wasn't completely empty, though. Enough crates remained to make a well-placed bulwark where gunners could be stationed.
Sanjay, let us proceed.
The driver lifted his foot from the brake and rolled forward, not stopping till a man carrying an assault rifle stepped out in front of him. Other men lurked in the shadows behind the crates. Habib opened the door and stepped out of the car.
Abdul Saidi.
I am here.
A thin man with a wide face and curly hair stepped from the crates on the left. In his 40s, he moved with a slight limp. He was in the Polisario Front, the liberation group trying to increase the holdings of the Sawari Arab Democratic Republic. His clothing was plain, a gray shirt and dark green pants that would allow him to vanish into the dock crowd if he had to. He carried an assault rifle in one hand, the barrel pointed up.
I am told you were followed.
CIA.
The CIA? You brought them here? What kind of betrayal is this?
No betrayal. This has been carefully orchestrated. Close the door. It is about to become quite noisy.
Close them!
Men sprang to close the warehouse doors. One of them turned around quickly.
There are guards out there! They have found us!
You have heard about me, Saeed. You know how I do business. I am always one step ahead of those who would offer me harm. Now put the rifle down and wait.
I should kill you right now.
Calmly, Habib nodded at his two bodyguards, both of whom had their weapons trained on Saeedi.
If you do, you will be the next to die. I promise you that. This trap was set by me, not my enemies, and they're about to find that out. If you doubt me, I can bury you here today as well. Put down your weapon. You and your men are safe in this place. The CIA agents out there are going to die. I decided to kill two birds with one stone.
In the Langley, Virginia headquarters, CIA Section Chief Brawley Hendricks stared at the large screen covering the wall in front of him in the ops room. Hendricks had gray hair and wore bifocals. In his early 60s, he'd been in this situation several times over the past few decades of his service. For the past 15 years, he'd been chasing terrorist vermin like Habib Ibn Thabit around the world. He'd gotten good at the job, but Habib had been the most dangerous man he'd ever tried to corner. The man was rising within the ranks of the known terrorists, filling the vacuum left by those they'd taken down in recent months. Terrorists were like the mythic Hydra. Cut off one head, and two more grew in its place. On the screen, several agents in vehicles converged on the warehouse where Habib had gone for his meeting. It appeared they finally had him. And with Habib Ibn Thabit, they would get a key to the Muslim terrorist group the CIA had been tracking for 3 years.
Keep breathing, Chief.
Craig Morley, the CIA liaison reporting to Congress and the Joint Chiefs on this particular operation, stood nearby. He was in his late 30s, enough of a political animal to roll with the punches by now, and to be wary of results till the dust had settled. Like Hendricks, Morley wore the tuxedo he'd had on the previous night when they'd found out Habib was on the move. They'd been attending a meet-and-greet, jockeying to suck up to the right holders of the purse strings all agencies coveted now that budgets were being cut. The section chief watched with increasing anticipation as the vehicles jolted to a stop and black-clad CIA special ops agents poured out. Hendricks had gotten to meet most of them, had hand-picked and recruited them for the task force. Hendricks pulled the headset microphone down to his mouth.
Okay, Swan leader, let's get that flock into the air.
At the front of the room, near the wall screen, but not looking at it because their attention was riveted on their individual computers, a handful of young agents monitored the operation. Three of those agents controlled drones. The spy vehicles were on site to monitor the situation and intercept radio signals, and if need be, they could track down anyone who escaped the invasion.
Swan team is online and is go.
On the screen, the three drones were in the air, marked in targeting triangles and identified with ID tags. They dodged and whipped across the rooftops toward the warehouse like oversized dragonflies.
Agent Hendricks, I thought I saw something in one of the surrounding buildings.
What?
I think there are people in the surrounding buildings.
Put it up on the screen.
I am. Moving from real time to rewind now.
A large section of the upper right-hand screen suddenly filled in with a view from one of the drones. The image slowed, tracking through the frames now, and finally stopped on a window of a nearby building just as a man dodged back inside. A curtain fell back into place, blurring the shadow behind the thin fabric.
Give me access to the team. Do it now.
Yes, sir.
The communications officer was a middle-aged woman who had worked ops like this before.
Patching you through now.
Swan leader, Swan leader.
Swan leader was Special Agent Paul Gentry. He'd been a bright kid with a bright future when Hendricks had recruited him from Virginia Tech. He could have been anything, but Hendricks had pulled him into the spy business. He wasn't even 30 yet.
Paul, get out of there. It's an ambush. Am I getting through?
No, we're blocked. Someone has cut off the comm. Switching to direct sat relays on handsets.
Before the special agents and all their military gear could set up, they were hit from both sides by rocket launchers. The narrow alley around the warehouse turned into a blistering battleground of explosive fury and flames.
Oh, my God. How did you know those men would be here?
They put a mole into my organization 7 months ago. It took me 2 months to figure it out, and 5 more months to determine how best to use him.
Habib walked to the rear of his vehicle and gestured to the driver. The driver reached into the car and triggered the trunk release. The lid rose slowly and revealed the man lying on his back inside the compartment. He was disheveled and bloody from the beating Habib's security people had given him earlier. His lips were split around the gag in his mouth, and one eye was swollen shut.
Since we were doing business together for the first time, I wanted to make sure you understood what I could do for you, and to you.
Habib hauled the man out. The prisoner fell heavily on the floor. Plastic ties held his hands behind his back and bound his ankles. He writhed, looking up at Habib.
You want the Moroccan government out of Western Sahara?
Yes.
Today, you and I share a common goal. King Mohammed is a lapdog for the Westerners, and he will never allow Western Sahara to belong to the Sahrawi people. You are having trouble securing weapons with which to continue your struggles there. I can get them to you, and I can do it more cheaply than others who might want to take advantage of you. I work to strike back at the Western world the same as you, and I am in a position to help you. All you have to do is accept that help.
And if I choose not to?
Then I will find another rebel who is willing to do business with me. But I tell you now that no one else will be able to get you the weapons I have waiting for you in the harbor for less than what I am offering. I have chosen you because you are a committed man. I know you will use those weapons.
All right. It will be as you say. We have a deal.
Good. Keep in mind, I am not a man who is afraid to get his hands bloody.
Habib smiled. Then he reached under his jacket and took out his pistol. He seized the prisoner's hair, tilted his head up, pressed the barrel into his forehead. Habib put the pistol away. Unhurriedly, Habib nodded to his bodyguards. They picked up the dead man and threw him back into the car. One of them closed the trunk. Habib pulled a card from his jacket and handed it to Saidi.
We should go, my friend. Call this number at 11 o'clock tonight. The final arrangements will be given to you at that time.
Thank you. Your faith in me and my men is not misplaced.
I did not think it would be.
Habib stepped toward the car and one of the bodyguards opened the door. He slid into the back seat. The bodyguards got in and they escaped via another exit. Flames still wreathed the dead bodies in the alley, and the driver didn't slow as he rolled over the corpses. Sanjay followed his escape route, easily avoiding the Algerian police. Habib relaxed in the back seat, taking a final glance at the carnage he'd wrought. Habib slipped the device from his pocket and glanced at the ID.
Hello?
A lost document written by Abdelallah Karam has just surfaced in Morocco.
Tell me what has happened.
Have you heard of Anya Creed?
Inspector Khoury worked out of a tiny office, but it was an office, not a cubicle. There was a feeling of privacy that the cramped quarters couldn't quite expunge. The inspector sat in front of an archaic computer and typed with two fingers. He wrote in his own language, so the only things Anya recognized on the screen were her name and the names of the dig crew. Waiting for Khoury to enter everything was mind-numbing and emotionally exhausting.
They are British citizens.
Yes, Miss Creed. I understood that the first time you told me, and it is here in my report. I must fill out this report if anything is to be done.
How long do you think it will take to do something?
I do not know. You are talking about the mountains. That is beyond the jurisdiction of this department. All I can do is forward this to the military. Perhaps they can do something.
Perhaps?
Miss Creed, you have to understand that what you are suggesting is not simple.
I'm asking for help for my friends.
Those mountains are very dangerous. The bandits make that region even more so.
Who can help them?
We can try. I am trying.
Perhaps you could try the British consul.
Surely you see the problems with that, Miss Creed. Imagine if I were mugged while visiting New York City. Then, instead of letting the local authorities deal with the matter, I called in the Moroccan embassy. Do you think the New York Police Department would sanction that?
No.
Good. Then we are in agreement. You can see how the military would be reluctant to go into those mountains.
I have their location on GPS. I've explained that.
I understand. And I have put that in my report. Now, please, let me finish in putting all the details.
Unable to sit any longer, Anya stood and gathered her things.
You've got all the information I can give you, Inspector. Sitting here watching you type it into your report isn't going to help.
You have given me their pictures, their location, and the name of the man you believe is behind this. Do you know where you'll be staying?
You can reach me through my phone. You have the number.
Very good.
Call me when you have news.
The very minute, Miss Creed.
Anya walked along the street, keeping watch in the windows of the small shops she passed. She waited till she cleared the police station before calling Garin Braden at one of the numbers he'd given her. Garin was the only man other than Rue linked to Joan of Arc's sword. At the time that Joan of Arc had been burned at the stake, Garin had been a young man given to Rue, Joan's protector, as a slave, more or less. And then Joan had died, and the sword had been broken. That was over 500 years ago. Garin had lived over 500 years. Anya didn't know how long Rue had been around. Their longevity was a mystery. They hadn't gotten along when Joan was alive, and the loss of her and the sword had been the final straw. They'd gone their separate ways shortly thereafter, relatively speaking, given the past 500 years, and remained somewhat distant. On several occasions, they had tried to kill each other. Since Anya had equally mysteriously made the sword whole, and it had claimed her, they shared an uneasy truce.
Hello, this is Mr. Braden's personal assistant, Inga. How may I help you?
Hi, this is Anya Creed.
Yes, Miss Creed. How may I help you?
I would like to speak with Mr. Braden, if I may.
I'm sorry, but Mr. Braden is indisposed at the moment. Might I take a message?
I would like Mr. Braden to return my call at his earliest convenience. The matter is life or death.
I understand, and I will give him your message. Several of Mr. Braden's dealings of late have been life or death matters. Might he reach you at this number?
Yes.
Mr. Braden will doubtless return your call when he is able. Have a nice day.
Anya called Rue, but the old man wasn't any easier to reach than Garin had been. Reluctantly, she pocketed her phone and glared up into the distant Atlas Mountains. Having no other choice, she flagged a passing taxi and headed for a hotel room. In the small hotel's hallway, Anya surveyed the door. Checking for telltale signs that the room had been invaded, she saw nothing. Anya entered and set her backpack on the floor near the tiny desk, pulled out her computer, and got to work. She quickly sent messages to each of the email addresses she had for Garin, asking that he get in touch with her. When she checked the GPS coordinates, the signal still blinked patiently. Anya took solace in the fact that she hadn't lost track of the team. Then, because she had no other choice yet than to wait, and because she was, at her best and her worst, curious, she opened up the responses she'd gotten from her blog postings. The first 6 emails were from people who more or less agreed with her assumption that the writing was Kufic. 2 of them thought it was a variant, but not one they'd seen before. The 7th email, from TaylorsBoy444@HouseOfFirenze, provided more enlightenment.
Hey, I recognize the name Abdelilah Karam as a little-known historian of the Rida Wars, which were also called the Wars of Apostasy. I'm sure you know those struggles came as a result of the argument over who would lead the Muslim people after Muhammad died. I don't know if this is the same person named in your document, but it would be an incredible find if it was. Karam has a couple of good pieces about the defense of Medina and the fallout that occurred afterward. Maybe he deserves more recognition? How did you find this? You didn't say.
That was interesting. Anya mused over that for a moment while she typed her thanks, but told TaylorsBoy444 she had to sit on the location of the find for the moment. The Rida Wars had taken place in 632 and 633, and they were headed up by Abu Bakr, Muhammad's father-in-law. Abu Bakr had been named the first caliph after Muhammad's death, but if this was the same Abdelilah Karam, what was he doing in Morocco? Once the caliphate had been settled, or at least reasonably functional, the Muslims had begun the invasion of Persia. Surely historians would have been far more involved with that than whatever had brought Karam to Morocco. And who had buried him in the foothills of the Atlas Mountains? And who had killed him? For what? Questions buzzed through Anya's mind like fighter planes. She was grateful for the distraction, but she kept checking the GPS coordinates. They were miles outside of Marrakesh. They had been traveling for the past few hours. Brawley Hendricks sat in his office and stared at the picture he'd taken with Paul Gentry only a few short years ago. The young agent looked so innocent and sincere as he smiled back at Hendricks. Beside Paul, his young bride, Heather, was pregnant. Hendricks had to make things right. even if it meant stepping outside the lines to get it done.
You doing okay?
Glancing up, Hendricks saw Morley standing in the open doorway. The liaison still looked shaken himself.
As well as can be expected, yes.
If you need anything...
Sure.
You should get out of here.
I will.
Morley hesitated, then he left. Quieting his rage, Hendricks shut down his computer, grabbed his coat and briefcase, and left the office. After his meeting with Heather, he knew what he had to do. The Curtain Bar occupied a niche on Washington, D.C.'s 14th Street, not far from K Street. Back in the 1970s, the area had been the city's red light district. Over the years, though, the neighborhood was cleaned up and was now home to small businesses that kept low profiles. Back in the day, Hendricks had gone there to get information and to hire people for less than savory purposes. Hendricks stood outside in the afternoon sun and lit a cigarette. He squinted through the smoke and looked out over the city, which had changed so much in the past few decades. In fact, he hadn't come calling on Sophie in almost a decade. He wondered if she'd changed. He knew he'd changed, now older and somewhat beaten down. He took his phone out of his coat pocket and looked at the screen.
You coming in, or you gonna stand out there and brood?
Hendricks smiled. He dropped the phone back into his pocket, crushed his cigarette underfoot, and walked toward the small bar. A hulking doorman stood in front of the plain wooden door with curtain written across it in small bronze letters. A coiled wire in one of the man's ears indicated he was connected with someone inside. The guy was nearly 7 feet tall and imposing in gangbanger fashion. As Hendricks approached, the man looked at something in one of his large hands, and Hendricks knew it was a smartphone that probably had his photograph on it. The man nodded but didn't speak. He thrust his chin toward the door, which popped open. Hendricks entered. The clientele at the bar watched Hendricks as he stepped into the small room. They were young and had the hard eyes of military people who had seen death up close. Hendricks recognized the look because he shared it. Times had changed. Almost as many women occupied the room as men now, and they weren't there as arm candy. They had hard eyes, too. The bartender was an older man, but still younger than Hendricks. A fact that made the CIA section chief feel even worse. A small television hung from the ceiling behind the bartender, turned to CNN.
Can I get you something, sir?
Scotch. Make it a double.
The bartender nodded, poured the drink, and handed it over. Hendricks raised an eyebrow. The bartender cut his eyes toward the back of the room, but made no move. Hendricks knew the man would have a weapon behind the bar. Turning, Hendricks looked down the row of booths at the back of the bar. No one sat there, as far as he could tell, but the last couple booths weren't visible. No one would get past the people in the room unless they were cleared. He carried his glass, less shaky now than he'd been back in his own office, and knew that he was about to step across a line he hadn't crossed in nearly 20 years. He found Sophie sitting in the last booth, and she didn't look much different from the last time he'd seen her. He guessed from their history that she was nearly as old as him, but she could have passed for his daughter. Her dark hair was cut shorter, more in step with today's styles, but it was the same color as it had always been. Her brown eyes stood out more, and her chin looked more forceful, more chiseled. Her lips and fingernails were bright red. The tabletop turned out to be a computer monitor that currently showed a small gray kitten playing with a ball of yellow yarn.
Hello, Brawley.
Hello, Sophie.
Have a seat.
Hendricks sat heavily, as if crushed by the weight of the world. He rested his forearms on the table. On the monitor, the kitten batted the ball of yarn over and over again, trapped in endless repetition.
It's been a while.
It has. You look good.
Thank you. I take care of myself. You smoking again?
Yeah, I just started back today. I'll quit again.
You always had the willpower to do things like that. Some of us have to live with our addictions. I heard about your protege today. I'm sorry. I'm sure you didn't let him go in without telling him it was a hard business.
I didn't.
Sometimes things just are what they are.
I remember telling you that once upon a time.
When I was summarily dismissed from the agency all those years ago? Yes, you did.
I helped you kill those men outside of CIA purview.
You did, only they didn't cut you loose.
I've heard the agency hires you for black bag jobs off the books.
Flatterer.
But it's true.
I can neither confirm nor deny. Isn't that how it goes?
I want Habib Ibn Thabit dead.
Sophie tapped the monitor with her painted fingernails and brought up footage from the attack in Algeria earlier that day.
I took the liberty of searching through your casework to find out why you might be coming to see me today. This is all I could come up with.
On the monitor, the alley was still filled with dead men.
The CIA wants Habib alive. They think he's the linchpin they can use to ferret out more terrorists.
I lost a good man trying to do that very thing. I'm not prepared to accept that loss. I want him avenged.
This isn't a revenge business. You told me that at the academy, as I recall.
Revenge isn't the agency's business. You and I know there are other things at work in the world. I helped you with yours. I need help with mine.
Habib is a ghost. I don't have anything more on him than you do.
I have something else.
What?
Habib has a special interest that no one else knows about. It fell into my lap today, and I've kept it out of the reports for the moment. I think he'll expose himself.
And if you're wrong about that?
Then I'm out of options and the man is untouchable.
What do you have?
There's a female archaeologist, Anya Creed, who seems to have discovered something in Morocco that has captured Habib's interest.
What?
A body, some kind of document. At this point, that's all I know. And that Habib is starting to move heaven and earth to find out more about her discovery.
Sophie didn't take notes, but she touched the monitor and brought up a website featuring Anya Creed and the cable TV show Chasing History's Monsters.
A very attractive young woman.
Yes.
If I agree to this, you're going to be putting her in harm's way.
She's already in Habib's sights. She could very well be in harm's way now, and this effort could save her.
This is a mercenary business, as you know. Where's the payday?
Habib is the payday. I can give you some of the particulars of his bank accounts. We've identified some of them in the Caymans and in Zurich, but we can't touch them. You can't.
Once I have Habib, perhaps, but only if we take him alive.
Keep him alive long enough for that.
How much money are we talking about?
Upwards of 9 million, and that's only what we've been able to discover. There will undoubtedly be more.
It's an intriguing proposition. Do we have an in for Anya Creed?
The archaeological team she was working with has been kidnapped by raiders. The Erfoud police and the Moroccan military haven't exactly been forthcoming with help.
Good. I like that. A search and rescue mission is always a good place to start.
Well, that's what I have. That's all of it. If it's not enough, tell me.
It's enough. You knew that before you came here. But you need to know something in return. I want the paycheck here. I'm not emotionally involved in this thing. The man I put on it won't be either.
Who do you have in mind?
Are you sure you want to know?
Hendricks immediately understood that she could only be talking about Rafe McKenzie. McKenzie had also been cut by the agency a few years ago. They'd used him primarily for wet work, and McKenzie had developed a taste for it that bordered on the psychopathic. Hendricks had handled the man, and had later taken point on ousting him from the CIA. If Paul Gentry was the good son that Hendricks had never had, Rafe McKenzie was the bad one.
Either way, I'm taking this deal. At this point, you don't have a choice. With or without those bank account records, I'm sending McKenzie after Habib. He's already in Mauritania. He can be in Erfoud by morning, after he finishes up his current assignment.
Rafe McKenzie stared through the mud and bug-smeared window of the 20-year-old Toyota SUV they were using for the op in Nouakchott, Mauritania, in northern Africa. Beneath the dented and paint-splotched exterior, a specially enhanced engine and transmission were protected by a reconditioned frame and underbody that had been strategically lined with bulletproof armor. Beside him, in the driver's seat, Yahya navigated through the traffic. Yahya was young, and he loved the hunt. He reminded McKenzie of a jaguar, sleek and dark and deadly. He didn't mind scaring those who fell into his clutches, and he was skilled in torture. He was also a good driver, but he lacked patience in traffic. Yahya bore down on the accelerator. McKenzie patted the slight man on the shoulder.
Slow down.
But I will lose the car.
You will not lose the car.
McKenzie settled back into his seat and watched the gridlock along Avenue Abdel Nasser. They were following the street in from Nouakchott International Airport to the center of the city.
Traffic is impossible.
The traffic is normal. Besides, we know where the diplomat is going.
Unless he stops somewhere.
Where would he stop?
Yahya tightened his fists on the steering wheel.
Just breathe. Everything is going to be fine.
At 34, Mackenzie wasn't old enough to be Yahya's father, but he often thought of the younger man as a little brother. For the past 3 years, he'd trained Yahya's rage into something more focused, a weapon. Yahya had raised himself on the streets of Cape Town, and Mackenzie, raised by a single mother in poverty in the U.S., had taken a shine to the young man while on an op there. Yahya was only one of Mackenzie's current mercenaries who stayed with him on every operation. With the others, it was only business.
We have another job after this one is finished.
We do?
Yes.
Where?
Morocco.
Yahya changed lanes smoothly and pulled past a slower-moving truck. Growing up as he had, he worried about the future, about the next job. He checked his mirrors, then pulled back into the lane he'd left, making space for himself.
Patience.
I will not lose that car.
During the years Mackenzie had worked for Sophie since getting kicked out of the CIA, he had never known her to give misinformation. That was why he never contested her percentage of the take. She was worth every cent. The next job presented the biggest payday Mackenzie had ever stood to receive. Not that he was looking to retire anytime soon. He enjoyed his work.
I have not been to Morocco.
I have.
What is it like?
Not much different than this place.
The languages?
Not so different either.
Sounds good.
It is good.
Mackenzie reached under his seat and brought up the H&K MP5 he'd hidden there. He kept the machine pistol in his lap at the ready, hidden under a jacket. He had a 9mm pistol holstered at his waistband in back.
Yes?
Can you speak?
This line is not secure.
I have eyes on your package.
Good.
Shall I set up an appointment?
Tell her I'll be in touch no later than tomorrow morning.
You can make the meeting?
Yes. What I have to do here won't take much longer.
Keep me apprised of the situation.
Of course.
Mackenzie put the sat phone away and watched the speeding car ahead of them.
All right.
Yahya grinned and bore down on the accelerator. Dining out turned into a working dinner. Anya found a small restaurant not far from her hotel and settled in. Beautiful and ornate tile covered the inner courtyard floor and walls where she was seated. The restaurant provided dining inside as well, but Anya preferred the open spaces. There was more room, and although there was a slight chill, Anya wasn't uncomfortable. With her phone and her computer fully charged, and with the mini-satellite receiver functioning, she was in total work mode. Wearing a microphone and headset, Anya opened up her Skype account and called Dr. Ernest Wolcott, an acquaintance at Harvard who specialized in Middle Eastern history, particularly the Caliphate. The call didn't go through immediately, and she was about to leave a message and log off when Wolcott accepted the connection and the computer monitor opened to a picture-in-picture. The professor was in his late 60s, dark-skinned from his Saudi Arabian mother and his African-American father. His father had been a lawyer working with the Kingdom of Saud when he'd met and fallen in love with Wolcott's mother, a much-removed member of the House of Saud. Wolcott was bald but had magnificent eyebrows over his dark brown eyes and a carefully trimmed gray beard.
Anya Creed, this is an unexpected pleasure.
Am I interrupting?
No, not at all. Grading students' work, separating those who actually put some time and effort into their assignments from those who watched something on the Discovery Channel. You'll be happy to know that I seem to have quite a few fans of your television show in my class these days.
That's a good thing?
When they're quoting most of your pieces, yes. When they're sourcing that Christy Chatham woman, not so much. And I have the distinct feeling that some of your content has been molested.
Molested is a good word for it.
I thought it might be.
As you might have guessed, this isn't a social call.
A social call usually involves some kind of meal. I see you're in the midst of one.
Sorry, I had to eat.
Not a problem. So, if this isn't a social call, let us agree that this is at least a very pleasant diversion. What can I help you with?
Quickly, Anya outlined yesterday's discovery, but left out the ambush by the Bedouin raiders.
Have you heard of Abdelilah Karam?
I'm afraid not. Should I have?
If you haven't, then he couldn't have been very important.
Yet someone killed him and left his body in Morocco.
Yeah.
Curious.
That's what I'm thinking, too.
Would you like me to do some legwork on this fellow?
I don't want to be an imposition.
One thing you definitely are not, Anya, is an imposition. Surprising, yes. Challenging, yes. But never an imposition. I would like to ask a small favor in return for my services.
What?
You can have the glory of the find. That's already yours. But, if possible, I would like to co-author a paper on what we may turn up. I'm afraid the publish or perish life of an educational functionary is never quite finished. The wolf is always at the door, and this sounds promising.
Absolutely. Of course you need your name in print.
Brilliant! This way I'll get to have my cake and eat it too. The self-satisfied among my colleagues will be scandalized if this turns out to be something and my name is on a paper with Anya Creed, co-host of Chasing History's Monsters. I would enjoy tweaking some of their noses.
Not worried about being tarnished by association with pop culture archaeology?
I relish the opportunity and pray that we meet with some kind of success. The very colleagues who would look down their noses at me would also be insanely jealous. I should probably let you go. I have a dinner date with a woman who loves me and puts up with me for God alone knows what reason.
Tell Miriam I said hello.
I will. And the next time you are here, you should stop in for dinner. She would love to see you.
I will. Goodbye.
Take care.
Anya broke the connection and gathered her things. Out in the alley, Anya spotted a man watching her from the deepening shadows. For half a block on her way back to her hotel, the man kept pace with her. She studied him in the glass windows she passed. He was too well-dressed to be a mugger, but he wasn't a professional man by any means either. He looked like a nicely dressed thug. Guessing from the easy manner and the clothing, the man was American or European. He kept his hands in his pockets, but there was plenty of room under the jacket for a weapon. Anya settled her backpack over her shoulders and turned at the next alley, moving quickly now. Once in the shadows next to an overflowing bin, she shucked out of the backpack and pressed back into the wall. The man came around the corner, still at the same easy pace. That told Anya he already knew where she was ultimately heading. That was unsettling. She stepped out of the shadows behind him. Before she could say anything, he whipped around, spinning to his right with a short-bladed knife glinting in his fist. Anya deflected the knife blow with her right forearm, bent her knees to slide beneath his arm. She delivered a left jab to his short ribs that felt as though she'd struck a side of beef. The man stayed on his feet and danced back. He dropped the knife to the cobblestones and smiled. He was good-looking, and he knew it, possibly in his early 30s.
Hey, no foul, Miss Creed.
Who are you?
You don't need to know me. I'm just a messenger. Don't kill the messenger.
He came around with that knife pretty quickly.
You surprised me. Not a wise thing to do.
Neither is tailing someone.
I came to deliver a message. The local police aren't going to do a lot to get your friends back. I have an associate who can help you.
Why would your associate do that?
It's his story. Let him tell you.
Does he have a name?
You got a favorite?
Hortense.
With slow deliberation, the man bent, picked up his knife, and made it vanish inside his jacket.
Good enough. He'll love that. Hortense will be in touch tomorrow morning. If you're nice, he might even buy you breakfast.
Am I going to see you again?
No. Good night, Miss Creed.
He turned and walked away. Reluctantly, Anya watched him go, wondering just exactly what she had gotten herself involved with. The next morning, after hearing the Skype notice on her laptop, Anya emerged from the bathroom. Wearing a robe, with a towel wrapped around her wet hair, Anya checked the time on her computer. It was 7:47 a.m. locally, which meant it wasn't yet 3 o'clock in Boston.
I have some information for you regarding Abdele Lakaram.
Seriously? You haven't been to bed?
I couldn't sleep. I started making calls to friends as soon as I got home from dinner.
Anya walked over to the window and peered out at the city. Erfoud was already bustling with the morning crowd and the influx of tourists. From her hotel, she could see the crowd swelling at the souk. Today was Saturday. The marketplace was going to do massive business. Vendors had set up tents, pushcarts, and roped-off areas filled with rugs, olives, spices, and handmade clothing. Anya checked the front of the hotel, visible from her room, and tried to spot the man she'd encountered the night before. She couldn't see him, but that didn't mean he wasn't there.
You kept other people up as well. Oh, Miriam must have been so glad I called last night.
I got consumed with the hunt for Karam. Would you care to know what I found out?
I'd love to hear what you found out.
Retreating from the window, Anya sat on the edge of the bed. She took one of her journals and a pen from her backpack. Later, she'd transcribed the notes to her computer, but the notebook shorthand worked when she didn't have access to electricity, or in case she got separated from her backpack.
I'm ready.
All right. From what I've learned, Karam was a historian of Muhammad and the first three caliphs.
That period of history covers at least from 630 AD to 661 AD, right? When Ali died after being attacked in the Great Mosque of Kufa.
By Abd al-Rahman ibn Muljan, one of the Karajite assassins who tried to assassinate the three rulers of Islam at the time. Yes, you know who the Karajite assassins were, don't you?
Kind of a catch-all phrase for Muslims who rejected Ali ibn Abi Talib's assumption of the caliphate. Loosely translates to those who went out.
Yes, Karam wasn't a young man. Assuming he might have started as an historian apprentice of 13 or 14 years, he had to have been in his 80s when he was traveling through Morocco. That could well account for why he didn't finish his journey.
He didn't finish because someone bashed him in the back of his skull.
Oh, yes, that fact had escaped me, but that does beg a question, doesn't it?
Anya wrote down the dates.
Who would murder an 80-year-old man? Yeah, that's occurred to me too.
The motive could have been robbery.
Robbers wouldn't have left the coins on him.
Maybe there was something else Karam was carrying that a murderer wanted.
Okay, let's go with that for a moment, but let's turn it around. What was an 80-year-old man doing so far from home? Did Karam have a family?
Unfortunately, we don't have that much information on his personal life. He wrote more about the Umayyad caliphs and Muhammad than he did about his own affairs.
How much of his material did you uncover?
There's not a lot to be had, unfortunately. But it is all detailed. That's why if your hunt turns out to be productive in turning up other documents, many historians will be interested.
We'll cross our fingers. What do we have from Karam?
Surprisingly, one of the best finds was discovered on a Spanish galleon that washed up on the Scottish coastline in 1987. Ship's records and artifacts led to a confirmation that the ship was one of those that was lost in the August storms that wreaked havoc on the Spanish Armada.
What was a document written by Karam doing on a Spanish ship? Not only is there a separation of hundreds of miles, but you're talking about almost 900 years of history.
One of those passengers was a historian who had an interest in Muslim affairs. His papers had been locked up with the captain's manifest, and all of that largely survived the storm and over 400 years of being sunk.
It's amazing what the sea holds on to.
And what she gives up. The historian wrote that he'd gotten Karam's papers from Morocco while taking passage on a Spanish vessel.
How?
Think about the time frame, Anya. The British and the Spanish were fighting each other over control of the Atlantic Ocean, and privateering was rampant. But they weren't the only pirates sailing those waters.
The Barbary Corsairs.
Exactly. The Corsairs were operating from Tunis, Tripoli, and Algiers, which were not far from Morocco.
Throw in the fact that a lot of the Barbary Corsairs were actually Europeans, and it's easy to make a case that your Spanish historian spent time here.
His name was Philip Gardner, and he was actually an Englishman.
An Englishman on a Spanish pirate ship?
Yes, that's not so unbelievable. Have you heard of Henry Mannering?
The English privateer turned pirate who got pardoned by King James I.
Mannering was indeed an English pirate, but he was also awarded letters of marque by Philip II, the then King of Spain. King Philip planned the attempt to overthrow Elizabeth I after she supported the Dutch revolt against Spain in 1587. He used Mannering against the British before King James offered royal forgiveness.
So Gardner was on a Spanish ship when it went down in the Atlantic?
Yes. One of my colleagues works at the University of Aberdeen and has been a prodigious researcher of Muslim history. He was quite excited when I told him you possibly found Karam's body and part of a document. I sent him a copy of the scroll that you sent me. He's quite good with Kufic. He managed to translate what you had.
He did?
Yes, but I'm afraid there isn't much. In the fragment you have, Karam sets up his case that he was chased from his home by assassins.
Why?
The document doesn't say. That's part of the missing information. But Robert told me that if you could get your hands on the rest of it, or any more of it at all, he'd be deeply indebted to you if he could see it.
That's not a problem. My Kufic is a little weak.
So is mine. Oh. At any rate, that's where we stand at the moment. But I shall endeavor to learn more. We still have to figure out how those documents came into Philip Gardner's hands and why the one you found was left in the Atlas Mountains. You'll contact me when you find out more?
Definitely. And can I get the translation your friend sent you?
Of course. I'll email it to you as soon as I hang up.
Anya forced herself to finish getting ready before sitting down at the computer. Within a few minutes, she was dressed in jeans, good hiking boots, and a green pullover. She pulled up the use.net accounts first. There had been some chatter, but nothing definite had emerged. She'd gotten more information from Wolcott. A quick check for the GPS markers showed they were still in place outside Marrakesh. Seeing them gave Anya hope. The next item on her agenda was to call Inspector Khoury to check on a potential rescue effort. Instantly on alert because it was early and she didn't know anyone in the city, Anya approached the door. She took hold of the doorknob and pulled the sword into the room with her.
Who is it?
Fortune.
What do you want?
You have friends in trouble. I'm here to help.
Why would you do that?
Because you need help. They need help. And if you don't get it to them soon, they're going to be dead, if they're not dead already.
Why should I trust you?
Do you have anyone else in mind for this job, Miss Creed? If so, I'll be on my way. Otherwise, let me into the room so we can speak.
Reluctantly, Anya opened the door. The man standing in the hallway was tall, dark, and handsome in a cold, distant way. He wore khaki cargo pants, hiking boots, and a shirt unbuttoned over an olive drab tank top. There was a cruel curve to his full lips. Wrap-around metallic green sunglasses covered his eyes. He showed her his empty hands, and she noticed the scarring over the knuckles and the old knife scar across his right palm that left the flesh puckered.
Invite me in?
Anya let go of the sword, stepped back, and opened the door. He walked into the hotel room alone.
You know who I am.
Call me Mac.
Is that your name?
I'll answer to it.
That's not exactly reassuring.
Your friends don't have a lot of time. That's not reassuring either. I thought you'd be more worried about them.
How did you find out about me?
I know a guy at the police department who keeps me informed of out-of-towners who get into trouble they can't handle. If I think I can do something, I offer my services.
I guess that guy's name is another name I don't get.
That's how this works.
You're a mercenary.
That's blunt.
I like blunt.
Sure, I'm a mercenary. That means I do what I'm paid to do. The fact that I'm still alive should tell you I'm good at it.
How much would you charge for something like this?
Extraction from a hostile situation? A lot.
I don't have a lot.
I understand that. I had you checked out. You got a little, but it would take time to get it. Anyway, I'm not after your money.
I've known a few mercenaries. Generally, they don't volunteer their services for free.
I'm not, but you're thinking about what you can raise yourself. There are other revenue streams involved in this operation.
What other revenue streams?
Mustafa doesn't just trade in slaves. His group also sells guns. And guns, especially in this part of the country, have an immediate resale value.
How do you know about Mustafa? The police inspector I talked to yesterday didn't mention that.
Because it's my job to know things like that. And because that police inspector isn't just going to volunteer information. If you want your friends back, you'll have to trust that I can do what I say I can do. That I'm a professional. When was the War of 1812? I know it started in 1812, but that's about it. If it was important to what we're going to do, I'd trust you to know everything you needed to. We're both experts.
I concede your point.
Good. What I'm suggesting is this. We both have something to trade. I have a team capable of extracting your friends from a bad situation. You have the means of guiding me to them and Mustafa. And Mustafa is rumored to travel with a sizable nest egg and gold and jewels, which I'll take as payment for my team services. That way you're not out a nickel and you get your friends back. If they're still alive. Is that too blunt?
No, that's fine.
Mac walked over to the window and peered out, keeping himself pressed against the frame to present a low profile.
How soon can you be ready to go?
I'm ready now.
Good, because I think you got company.
What do you mean?
Mac pointed through the window and Anya joined him. Down in the street, a pair of black SUVs braked to a stop in front of the hotel. Men in suits got out, and they looked to be Middle Eastern. The drivers stood beside the vehicles. Eight other men strode toward the hotel's front door. Mac remained calm and unhurried as he let go of the window drape and freed a semi-automatic pistol holstered at his back.
Do you know them?
No. And why do you think they're here after me?
Maybe they aren't. Maybe they're after some other American pop culture star who's staying at this low-rent hotel. You want to hang around and take the chance?
Not really.
If I'm wrong, we got an early start and you can chalk me up as paranoid.
Mac looked around at the room.
You need much of this stuff?
Nope.
Anya folded her computer and stuffed it into her backpack. The mini-satellite dish went into a protective pocket. She hauled the backpack over her shoulders. Max stepped past her to the door. He grinned at her.
Never met a woman who could pack so fast.
I'm feeling inspired.
Keeping his hand on his pistol under his shirt tail, Mac opened the door and filled the opening so that Anya couldn't pass. Close on his heels, she peered over his shoulder. Two maids with pushcarts occupied the hallway. No one else was around.
Let's go.
Mac took the lead and headed toward the back of the hotel, moving quickly toward the steps. Anya moved with him. She silenced her phone as soon as it rang, noting the caller ID. Garin. She accepted the call and pulled it to her ear.
Now may not be a good time.
I'm returning your call. Do you know how many people are waiting for me to call them back even as we speak?
Is there going to be a test?
Mac flicked an irritated glance at her as he opened the stairwell door and went through.
Put the phone away.
Give me a minute.
A minute for what?
I'm in Morocco.
Am I supposed to be interested?
Mac headed down the stairs and Anya shadowed him.
I was calling to ask for help.
Still not interested.
Some friends of mine have been captured by Bedouin slavers.
Then write them off or set them free. If they don't have anything you want, there's no reason to take the risk.
Not exactly the answer I was looking for.
I'm not the Yellow Pages. You're not the only person with problems. What do you need?
Nothing. You called too late.
Annoyed, Anya broke the connection and pocketed the phone, turning to follow Mac as he reached the first floor.
Who were you talking to?
A friend.
Does your friend have a name?
Yes.
Holding back information isn't smart.
He doesn't have anything to do with this.
For a minute, Mac looked as if he was going to argue with her. Then he focused his attention on the hotel's rear door. Opening it, Mac peered out. Anya glanced behind her and saw three of the men in black suits come around the corner from the main lobby. They spotted her at the same time and reached under their jackets.
Anya Creed, stay where you are!
With a quick lunge, Mac caught Anya's elbow with his free hand and yanked her toward the door, throwing her off balance. She was halfway through the exit before she knew it. At the same time, he took one step in front of her and raised his pistol. Morning sunlight slanted down into the narrow alley between the hotel and the building behind it. The alley was so narrow that the black SUV hurtling down it almost scraped on both sides. Through the dark windshield, a Middle Eastern driver kept both hands on the wheel and accelerated. Max stepped out into the alley. The bullets cracked the windshield in several places and skipped from the hood and roof. Then he put a hand in the middle of Anya's back and shoved.
Run!
Anya ran, knowing the alley was too long and that they'd never reach the other end of it before the SUV overtook them. Anya spotted an arched doorway only a short distance ahead of her. She ran and hoped that she didn't trip over a cobblestone, trying not to think about how close the SUV was getting. She dodged to the right and fit herself into the doorway, pressing up hard against the wooden barrier as she slid her backpack off one arm into the side. She reached out and caught Mac, pulling the man into the doorway with her. His body slammed into hers as the SUV caught him a glancing blow. She held on tight to his jacket, hoping he wasn't badly hurt. The SUV driver braked. Anya peered into the alley, thinking maybe they had time to sprint back to the other end. At the same time, though, the men inside the hotel boiled out into the alley and spotted her. Ducking back, Anya tried the door. It was locked. Beside her, Mac changed magazines and released the slide of his pistol. He didn't appear to be injured, and he looked calmer than she felt.
Door's locked.
He glanced at the door, then took aim at the lock. The locking mechanism was reduced to broken metal. Mac pushed the door open. Anya bolted into the courtyard, a larger, ornate riad. It fronted three stories of apartments. Wrought iron railings ran around the floors and stairs that led to the upper floors on two sides. Behind Anya, Mac fired his pistol.
They're here.
Did you come to me by yourself?
No.
Anya yanked the straps of her backpack back on.
Where's your team?
I've got a driver waiting, a couple of extra men, but they're not ready for something like this.
The SUV backed up to the open door. A man rolled down the window and took aim with a machine pistol. Mac fired a few shots and drove the man back into hiding.
Come on.
Anya sprinted forward, ignoring the stairs. She leaped for the second-story landing's edge. She caught hold and hauled herself up, climbing the railing and lunging for the next. Mac put his pistol away and climbed up after her. Bullets slapped the front of the building. On the second floor, Mac flipped over the railing instead of following Anya up to the third floor. He drew his pistol and took deliberate aim at the man firing at them from the SUV. Hauling herself up, Anya glanced over her shoulder and saw the gunner in the SUV fall backward, already limp in death as his face gushed blood. She chinned herself onto the rooftop, then swung herself sideways to get a leg up on the edge and stay low. Mac holstered his weapon again. He stood and climbed to the railing to haul himself up to the third floor.
As far as exit strategies go, this one sucks.
Only if we don't make it.
The SUV pulled forward, away from the front door, and the gunners from the hotel swarmed into the Riad. They opened fire at once. One of the bullets struck the roof line near Mac's right hand. The roof crumbled in his grip. He swung wildly, barely maintaining his one-handed grip. Anya reached down and caught a handful of Mac's jacket. She pulled as hard as she could, adding her strength to his. His feet scrabbled for purchase, and he came over the roof's edge, immediately sprawling across the curved roof tiles. A few of them shattered under his weight. Pushing herself up into a crouch, Anya headed toward the peak. The steep angle of the roof made the going harder and even more dangerous. When she reached the peak and spotted Mac struggling to come up behind her, Anya caught hold of one of the tiles and set her feet on either side of the summit. Then she whipped her body as though she was throwing a frisbee. The half-pipe tile whirled through the air and caught one of the gunmen in the face. The man collapsed backward as the broken tile tumbled down his body. Mac hauled himself across to safety. Bullets still cracked the tile, then quickly stopped. Anya crept out to the roof's edge and looked across. The next house was within easy jumping distance. She looked back at Mac and discovered he'd assumed a prone position with his pistol pointed before him.
Are you coming?
Give me a sec.
One of the men clambered up the roof after them. As soon as their pursuer's head cleared the roof line, Mac put a bullet between his eyes, snapping his body back. Mac turned toward Anya and carefully crossed the roof.
That'll hold them for a minute, but they'll be circling the building, and I don't know how many there are.
Without a word, Anya took the lead. They raced across the rooftops, moving across five other houses. Anya and Mac dropped into another alley. Mac took out his sat phone.
Come get us, now.
He put the phone away. Anya walked toward the end of the alley. The street looked clear.
Who is that?
A friend. I'll introduce you in a minute. He's coming to pick us up.
Then what?
Then we get my team together and go get your people. You had some good moves back there for an archaeologist.
We were lucky.
Yeah. We were.
Do you know who those men were?
Yeah. They work for a guy named Habib Ibn Thabit. Do you know him?
No, I don't.
Guy's a terrorist. One of the really bad ones. The CIA's tracking him all over the place. Habib networks money for other terrorist organizations. Put cells into motion to strike big targets.
Did he follow you here?
Not me. Guy must have been after you. I barely beat him here. If I hadn't gotten to you when I did...
Doesn't make any sense. I've never had any contact with this guy. Why would he come after me?
I don't know.
Then how do you know those guys belonged to him?
Me and Habib, we've traveled some of the same circles. This isn't the first time we've traded paint.
Traded paint? You're American. The accent is from the South. You're a NASCAR fan?
The term came from the sport when two cars bumped into each other during a race and traded paint.
A word of advice, Miss Creed?
Sure.
Don't get to know me any more than you need to. We've got a business transaction, nothing more. I get your friends out of trouble, I keep you safe, I get Mustafa and his treasure cave. We keep that straight, we're going to do fine. Understand?
Yeah, perfectly.
Once they stepped into the street, a small sedan that had seen better days pulled to the curb. A young black man sat behind the wheel and looked anxious. He eyed Anya, then Mac.
Are you okay?
I'm good.
Mac opened the back door, then waved Anya in. She slid over. Mac got in beside her. The young driver glanced over his shoulder, took his foot off the brake, and edged into traffic.
I saw those guys getting out at the hotel. I almost came after you, but you told me to stay with the car.
You did as I told you to. Everything was fine.
The driver paused at a corner and glanced over his shoulder.
So, you're Anya Creed?
I am.
I am Yahya. Do not worry, Miss Creed. Mac and I will take care of you.
Yahya accelerated. Anya leaned back against the seat and looked at the street. Less than 30 minutes later, Anya stood in a warehouse at the edge of Erfoud. Mac had chosen the place as a staging area for his troops. He'd gathered 8 more people to fill out his team. 6 of them were men with obvious military training. 2 were women, one African and the other Middle Eastern. The men wore street clothes and the women wore hijabs. Anya didn't think that necessarily made them Muslim, but it disguised them. In Morocco, women tended to be invisible. The team moved as though they'd all worked together before. They had an easy camaraderie, a confidence. Mac and Yahya were obviously the most familiar with each other. Anya had picked up on the mentor-apprentice relationship. The others were purely professional. She had expected the mercenaries to be heavily armed, but they mostly carried personal weapons, pistols and knives, though the Middle Eastern woman carried a cut-down pump shotgun under her white wool burnoose. Anya held her sat phone to her ear in hopes of reaching Bart McGilly.
Anya?
Yes, look, I know I'm calling at a bad time.
What time is it?
Here or there?
What?
It's early there, 4 a.m. or so.
Are you in trouble?
No.
You don't make a habit of calling me at 4 a.m. when you're not in trouble. That could end our friendship quicker than just about anything aside from setting fire to my home or killing my pet. You still in Morocco?
Yeah, I ran into a guy here. I'd like to have him checked out.
Guy in Morocco? And you want me to check him out here in New York?
Trust me, if this is who I was told he is, he'll show up when you start looking for him.
Let me get a pencil. Now, give me a name.
Habib Ibn Thabit.
Anya did, and Bart put Anya on hold. She listened quietly and watched Mac and his group. One of the team was already working at a notebook computer.
This guy you're wondering about? He's trouble, Anya. The killing kind. Habib's got his photograph on every major wall through the intelligence arena. I'm talking CIA, NSA, FBI, NCIS, everybody. How did you run into this guy?
Some of his men came after me this morning.
You're sure about that?
Pretty sure.
What did they want with you?
I don't know. I didn't stick around to ask. Could you check into this Habib guy and let me know what you find?
Sure. But you want my best advice? I'd say get out of there. Drop whatever you're doing and head home.
I can't.
Anya, whatever you're working with, it's probably centuries old. Trust me, it can cool off for a while. At least until you regroup. Let me do some digging. I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
Thanks.